I think we are just coming up, so I'm going to go ahead now and mute all. And as usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards. Later on this evening, Alan will post the contents of the deck in PDF format, as well as the audio track and the contents of the chat window. Feel free to also use the chat window if you have any questions or comments or anything of that nature. And I think with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. I'm just trying to find you to give you slide control. There you are. I think Bob Harris too. There we go. Okay, we're all set to go, I think. Okay, so welcome everybody. We have another mixed bag tonight, so let's just get started. And first up, I just have a share about bug reporting. You know how well I do with the feedback hub on the Microsoft side of things. I never hear back from anything I say there. But I recently found a tiny problem with the OneDrive GUI client, which I think I wrote an article about. I may have talked about it here. Basically, this is a Linux app that accesses OneDrive and synchronizes files between OneDrive and a folder. So you can use things like Microsoft Word 365 fairly easily on Linux. The issue was, if you look at the one of the screens here, when you do the installation, the third bullet down says press save. But if you look carefully, you won't find the save button. And what they've actually done is the button that you want to press is actually called log in. So I thought, well, why not just tell people about that? So I went on to the bug reporting scheme and told them basically how to reproduce the bug. It was pretty obvious. And what I expected to be able to save, or if you're going to use login, then you should change the instructions to say press login. Anyway, the developer very quickly changed it, and you can see here the actual code commit, and you can see where he's changed in the pink, he's changed the message to say login to in the green to say save. So if you now use that OneDrive GUI application, it will actually work basically as advertised. Okay, so GitHub works for me, but Feedback Hub, unfortunately, does not. There's an e-waste event coming up. If we're getting close to the Windows 10 end of life, and if anybody's buying new computers and wants to get rid of old equipment, or any other kind of equipment, doesn't have to be just Windows computers, there is an electronics recycling e-waste event coming up at the Ottawa Tool Library. And the tool library is somewhere where you can borrow various kinds of tools like chop saws and belt sanders and that kind of thing. So if you don't own one, you can loan it from this tool library. So as well as running the e-waste event, they're also offering tours of the facility. So if you want to know more about it, then just check the URL there and go and take the tour. Okay, next up we have another, that was a Loony Link because it's a Canadian website. And we have another Loony Link, which Stu is going to unmute himself and tell us all about.
Ah, yes. Well, this came about because I was considering sharing some information on a couple of financial institutions I learned about recently, and one catered to a specific clientele, and it was pretty niche, and I thought, nah, this isn't really that interesting to the group. And the other one was sort of an online-only thing with supposedly higher interest rates than average, kind of like Tangerine used to be back when it was ING Direct, which it isn't anymore. So, and I thought, well, I don't really know if it's that great an interest rate they're offering. And I thought to myself, well, there's got to be some way to actually do an online comparison of banks and interest rates offered by different accounts. God, somebody must have made an app or something for this. And so without using AI, I just did a search. It's shocking, I know, people, but basic searches still work. A few websites popped up, and one of these. And it's a government website. So it's a silly service, LoonyLink. And what it does is, it compares interest rates from banks all across Canada. This slide Alan put together shows what happens when you input some of the specifications for your needs, and you can compare a couple of banks that fill those needs. It's pretty straightforward. You just go there and you say what province you're in, how much you're willing to pay for a certain type of bank account, how many children you have, are you going to sell a kidney or not, you know, all the usual things banks want to know. And they give you a list of choices. And because it's a government website, well, every bank in the country's got to be registered with it, right? Or at least they technically should be registered with the government in some fashion, you would think. But anyway, if you're looking for something that might fill your specific needs for an investment vehicle, this is freely available from the government. And it's unadvertised. So I'm stepping forward and doing my civic duty, promoting a Canadian government resource that nobody knows about, except for probably the guy that created it and a few of his buddies. Take it away.
Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. And I'll just add that in addition to comparing different banks and things, you can actually set a number of filters to narrow down the things that you're interested in. And you may see on the top line there, I selected and I was interested in accounts for seniors. I didn't care about monthly fees. And then I told it the banks I was interested in. Okay, so next up we have a share from Chris, the answer to whether Rogers is going out of business.
Well, not exactly going out of business, but are they going to abandon email? And this has been an ongoing thing with Rogers for a while, actually. Their support for @rogers.com email addresses has been spotty at best. I use Rogers now, and so I never actually asked them for a Rogers.com email address, and then I decided at one point that I wouldn't mind actually having one just for a test account. And so I tried to set one up, and due to some weird oddities that I had, I never was able to actually get it completely configured in that. However, I heard other people having problems with Rogers.com email addresses and configuring them and recovering from errors and things like that. So I started looking into it a little bit more. And officially, they're not abandoning any of the Rogers.com email addresses. However, if I can advance this, there, whoop. For some reason, when I start doing the advances, the first couple of clicks don't seem to take, and then they stack up. So there are some important limitations and issues that are around right now. On April 3rd, 2024, Rogers stopped allowing customers to create a new email address. And I thought that was interesting, and it didn't even get an awful lot of press that I heard about. They say the existing email addresses will remain supported, and they have no plans to take them away. However, there have been ongoing and unresolved technical issues for a long time on that. And Rogers doesn't run their own email system. It's actually Yahoo that they contract with to provide the actual email. It's driven recommendations by a lot of people to switch to other email providers entirely rather than just sticking with Rogers.com. And so if you do have technical issues with your existing one, yeah, it might exist forever or as long as Rogers exists, but if you have technical problems, they might never get resolved. So there's strong community advice in blogs and things like that to back up your mail, export it, or migrate to a new provider because of these problems that exist on there. So I went looking for, well, what would you actually replace it with then if you are a Rogers customer? And so I always recommend avoiding using ISP-supplied emails. And it's not just that, well, you have a company like Rogers who might have problems with technical issues that they can't resolve and so forth. If you use a Simpatico.ca or Rogers.com or whatever email address, you lock yourself into that ISP. If you wanted to change ISPs, it becomes much more difficult because then you think, now I got to change my email address and I've got to let, you know, all my friends know, and every website that I use it for authentication, I have to go and change and all kinds of things like that. So I think it's actually best to never use an ISP-supplied email. It's probably the worst choice that you can actually make. The next best choice is to actually go to one of the really big email providers that'll do it for free, and just go with something else there. So I went looking. What can you actually get? A really big email box for free. Oh, I have a font problem because I passed this on to Alan and I used a different typeface for really big that he doesn't have. My bad. So free and big mailboxes. So there's a lot of options out there. By going to one of these, you can change ISPs freely and your email doesn't change. And it isn't affected by poor management by smaller companies, companies like Rogers that maybe are not going to be as responsive to technical issues as some of the big providers. So I did a quick search, and some of the ones that are pretty generous on their free tiers. So Gmail will give you 15 gigabytes, but that is shared with Google Drive, Google Photos, basically all of the Google properties out there you share in that 15 gigabytes. Outlook.com, which is run by Microsoft, will give you 15 gigabytes, and that's separate from the 5 gigabyte free space that they'll give you on OneDrive. Yahoo Mail will give you 20 gigabytes, and I have a Yahoo Mail email address that I just had for testing purposes. I didn't realize that it used to be 1 terabyte, and it was just in July of this year that they reduced it to 20 gigabytes. Mail.com will give you 65 gigabytes free, and AOL Mail will give you 1 terabyte of free space on your email box. So all of them support, you know, your basic web access, which is natural, and they all support POP and IMAP if you want to use a local client on your computer for accessing mail instead. So if you don't mind appearing really old school, you know, a free 1 terabyte mailbox at AOL might be your ideal choice. So they're all free of charge. You can get as many as you want. So more to come on this. February 11th at the general meeting for the PC User Group, Alan and I are tag-teaming on the ins and outs of electronic mail. We're going to cover off on an awful lot of aspects of it, things like what is the difference between webmail and email client software that you install on your computer? What does it mean to be using POP or IMAP, and how do you set them up? We'll talk about some of the security issues surrounding email, how to use folders and filters to organize your email, backing up, transferring address book and mail folders, and portable and disposable email addresses so that you can give out one of these addresses to somebody you really don't trust, and then if they decide to abuse the rights you've given them to use your email address, you can drop that. So just some upcoming stuff that you might want to look into. That's it.
One question or request. Can you look into the ability to search and how fast it is as part of your evaluation of email?
I would say possibly, but my intention is not to actually go and try any new email service as part of that January or February presentation. My intention is to talk strictly about how you configure things, but I'm not going in and installing any new clients' software. I'm not going to go and set up new email boxes with any other provider. So I would not be able to answer that question myself.
Yeah, if I had a terabyte of data, I'd like good searching facilities for some reason.
Yeah, well, a good point. Yeah, for sure.
Now, most of the email systems do have search. Webmail does and Thunderbird does. How efficient they are, I don't know, but they work for me.
There was
a couple of things in the chat, Chris. Dan says that Proton Mail has a 1 gigabyte allotment.
Yeah, that's good.
And Steve wants to know what the maximum email message size is on AOL.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't looked at it. I'm sure that you could Google it or Perplexity AI it and come up with that. I set up an AOL box, but I haven't played with it at all. So I'm afraid I don't know that off the top of my head.
Okay, all right. Thanks very much, Chris. Next up is Stefan, who has a cautionary tale. NVIDIA video cards. Stefan, you'll have to unmute.
Yeah, I did. So, in my experience with the NVIDIA video cards, it takes months, even years, for drivers to stabilize and work correctly. Like, for example, in February of 2023, so maybe 2 years and 6 months ago, I bought a new PC. And on the first day, I had a very strange bug that in an application that I had like text that I was typing, either Windows, Word, PowerPoint, Notepad, doesn't matter where I was typing, the first character was okay, but when I was typing, the second character, the first one was disappearing, and if I was clicking on that character, it was reappearing. So this is what I knew, it was some kind of weird problem with the video driver, and it took NVIDIA. I don't recall how many updates, 4 or 5. It took a long time before they fixed that problem. Now, next slide, please. Oh, back.
Sorry, hang on a second here. There we go.
Okay. So in the last few months, maybe 5 or 6, I got another weird problem with my NVIDIA GeForce RTX 3060. Which is connected to an Asus monitor. The problem was a random black screen for just a shy less than 1 second. And this was occurring 10 times per day, which became very annoying. I look, and to date, NVIDIA has updated many times their drivers since that problem appeared, and none of them have fix that problem. I'm pretty sure that one of the previous updates caused that problem because I didn't have it like 9 months ago. Next slide. So I went on Google, hit it pretty hard, and looking, doing a search almost weekly, and I stopped counting how many pounds posts to find a solution that actually worked for me or is being reported as working. So the solution that I found in one of the posts was to change in Windows the setting for choose a refresh rate. So it's under System, Display, Advanced Display, and in there you have a drop-down box that you can choose the display rate. And the video card, if you're using HDMI and my Asus monitor will talk, and it will determine which refresh rate is supporting. So in the post I read, people said to drop it like to 59.999. I tried that one, didn't make a whole lot of difference, but when I dropped it to 50 hertz, great improvement. So my frequency went down from maybe once a week versus many, many times per day. So great improvement, but I still hope that NVIDIA will fix these problems once and for all.
So just a question there, Stefan. So did you report this bug to NVIDIA?
Yes, not me personally, but in all, like almost all of the posts that I read on that, everybody said, oh, I reported to NVIDIA, but it don't seem to be in a big hurry or care. But I guess there are so many people reporting as a bug that one of the posts that I read was that NVIDIA was starting to seriously look at this problem and fixing it. Many posts that I found, including the AI from Google, said, oh, you need to use a third-party tool called DDU, Display Driver Uninstall. And it's not even provided by NVIDIA. It's another strange website. And I was just that close to try that program, but I had to reboot Windows Safe Mode to run that application. And when I did search specifically on DDU, I found more posts. And most of them, I will say 90% of them, they all said, did not work. I only found that changing the advance, the refresh rate in maybe one post around about 100 that I read, that most people were replying and saying, it worked for me. So that's what I did. It worked, I guess, 90% of the time, which is pretty good.
Yeah. Pretty good is not terribly great, though. One thing I will comment is that keep on top of updates, because NVIDIA comes out with updates every month for their drivers.
Yeah, I know. I get a message that pop up.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that one of these months they will fix it.
Yeah, hopefully.
Tom's asking if it's an HDMI connection.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Stefan. Good luck with that bug.
Yeah.
Okay, next up we have a share from Harvey. So, Harvey, you're going to...
You have the
slide. Houston, tell us all about...
There we go.
Yeah, okay.
All right, just a little bit of background. August the 6th of our Q&A, I did a presentation called Setting Up a New Computer, and it detailed and described all the various steps in great detail, and would help you through the process of setting up a new computer. Now, this set of slides tonight, I've had the opportunity for three of my clients to set up new computers, because theirs is just so much outdated, and of course they're all Windows 10. So in this particular situation, the contractor was my client, and he had an old HP Tower, Windows 10. Now, before you do any of this, you have to make sure that your Windows 10 is at the latest version, so 22H2, the i7 Intel processor was not compatible. He had very little memory, and he had the old-fashioned HDD SATA drive. But luckily, it is what they call a GPT profile, which is the only accepted profile for Windows 11. Now, they had several applications on their machine, and this process will simplify the setup onto your new machine. You will not have to dicker around and reinstall everything. So the new machine they're using is called a B-Link. It's a mini PC. You can see on the right there. It's about 5 inches long. It's about 4.5 inches wide and about 1.6 inches tall. So it's very compact. It does come with Windows 11 Pro already built in onto their SSD. It's an AMD Ryzen processor, so it's probably equivalent to an i7. And, of course, it has 32 gigs of RAM. Now, on the next slide, Go ahead.
Yeah, it will change.
Uh-oh.
There we go.
It's broken. So what we're just going to go through very thoroughly, all these points we have, we're essentially what we're doing, we're transferring all of the HP information onto the B-Link. Now, what we're doing is I install Macrium Reflex, it's the free version, on the HP workstation. And at that time, we create a disk image backup. And we label that as retain as the original, just in case things don't go properly. Now, the duration for copies was quite considerable. So 193 gigabytes with an hour and 30 minutes. The next step, I analyzed using disk management, and I found a large recovery image partition on that drive, and we do not want to bring that across over to the new computer. So in doing so, to eliminate that, we have to use what we call disk part. I don't know if they've ever used that before to do some work on partitions. And we use a command called force delete procedure. And that deletes that partition. Now, because we've done that, we've changed the image. So again, we're going to do a create a new disk image. And this time we're labeling it as B-Link. And it's a little less time to copy, but not too much. It's an hour and 20 minutes. Now, at that point, we can essentially shut down the old machine, put it aside, and hold it just in case for backup. We can go on to the next slide, Alan. Now, what we do then is we connect the B-Link, all the cables to monitors and power and all that. We fire it up, and we do an initial Windows 11 setup. Now, the only purpose for doing that is we're going to install Macrium onto the B-Link. However, we're going to use the rescue media, which is a USB drive, to start the computer so that we can then copy this B-Link disk image over to the B-Link solid-state drive. Well, that took an hour and 20 minutes. So at that point, you have now transferred all of the old computer information onto the new computer. So at that stage, we now start up the B-Link just to make sure everything is working. The hardware profiles, as you probably are aware, are built each time you start Windows, it'll build it based on what it detects. So you don't have to worry about hardware profiles and manual things like that. Now, we did do a Microsoft PC health check just to confirm everything is compatible with Windows 11. Now, that computer at that point is still Windows 10. However, it's all compatible, the processor, et cetera, so what we do at that time, we run the Microsoft Windows 11 installation assistant, and that will put on the Windows 11 operating system. Now, once you're finished that, you should have the drivers for that B-Link. You're going to apply those. You're going to do your Windows update. That's normal. And adjust a few settings here and there. So make sure it's properly activated, your Windows, and make sure Windows Restore is active and create an initial restore point at that point. So everything is running super smooth. It does lessen a heck of a lot of setup time, but as I mentioned, just make sure you do these backups and keep track of them. Just to be on the safe side. So if you have any questions, you can email me or send me a message somehow. Thanks.
Hey, thanks very much, Harvey. Okay, next up we have...
We did have a question from Tom asking, Harvey, did you consider changing the motherboard and CPU instead?
Not at all.
Okay.
I can send over the computer, Tom, if you want to play with that.
Would I have done one thing differently? The first time I would have started the B-Link with the Windows 11 Pro, so I don't lose the Pro of the operating system. I would have find the activation key and write it down on a piece of paper and do all the other steps that you mentioned. And when it's up and running on Windows 11, I would have switched the key to the original Windows 11 Pro key. And in theory should have worked, and now you have Windows Pro on that machine instead of just a regular Windows.
Excellent. This is a Windows Pro. It just carries over. Yeah. That's a good point for Richard. Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot. So next up we have a share from Bob Harris. And Bob, you have slide control, so you should be able to change the slides yourself.
And Bob, you'll have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. I like the idea of Harvey getting a whole new machine. That makes more sense than adding parts to it. I did the same thing myself. So, good call. Making sure my slide control works here. I'm going to go back to Harvey's. There it goes. Okay, good evening, folks. When you hear VPN, you might think it stands for Very Private Nachos. Let's be honest, who wouldn't want to keep their nachos private? But here's a secret. VPN does not mean very private nachos. However, I want you to imagine a dog happily ready to chow down on a big plate of cheesy nachos. And then, all of a sudden, poof! They're all gone. Well, that's what a VPN does to your data. It makes all your online activity disappear from anyone or anything that could be snooping on your stuff. Now, let's get started. If all goes well, I hope to show you what is a VPN and why you should care. Virtual private network is a secure tunnel, like a privacy envelope for your internet data. Whatever you're doing, banking, emailing, streaming, it all goes down this protected tunnel. Without a VPN, your internet provider, advertisers, even governments can track you. A VPN makes it a lot harder to track you. So why do you need a VPN in today's digital world? Well, whether the websites track you, cookies, ads, even location. With a VPN, you can browse privately, even access content from other parts of the world that could be blocked in your area. Going on further, why are prices higher the second time you check? If you check for a flight booking, an airplane flight, whatever, and then realize you go back a second time and it magically increased, that's called dynamic pricing. Some websites and travel sites mark you as interested and then bump up the price. It's like the store clerk saying, oh, you came back. You're clearly very interested. I can charge you a bit more. You're hooked. Well, and some stores, of course, offer new visitor discounts, and a VPN helps you get that. Now, so if you're shopping online, you want a better deal. Flights, hotels, subscriptions are often cheaper from different countries. You can compare the price with your VPN, but don't forget your cookies or use an incognito browser so you won't come in as the same person. So, let's discuss about free VPNs. many or most free VPNs are absolutely terrible. They log your data and they auction off your information. They bombard you with ads. So as usual, when something is free, you are the product. However, Proton is different. Let's check this out. Proton VPN has many reviews. This is only one of many from a CNET in July, and they say Proton is the rare exception to the rule that free VPNs are underwhelming at best. So why is this true? Well, Proton is founded by the CERN scientists. And it was one of those scientists, I believe, that actually invented the World Wide Web. So these people really understand security. And they're based in Switzerland, where the privacy laws are among the strongest in the entire world. And they support global freedom projects like Proton Mail and Proton Drive. So getting back to the Proton account, there's two main Proton accounts, a free one and a paid version. And the free one gives you one device. There's no speed cap. If the speeds are available, you got them, and they're fast. There's no ads. You get servers in three countries. I did this a while ago, and I think they're up to seven or five countries now. So you have quite a wide selection of what you want to use for that. The paid plan has more servers, faster feeds, and more features. But the free plan is great for occasional and regular users. Now you might say, if it's free, why is it free? Well, they work it out so that they believe everybody should have the VPN, but they make that the free users pay for the paid users pay for the free users. And of course, I'm sure sometimes the free users go up to the paid users, but there is no catch. There are no ads. They don't sell your stuff. So anyway, getting it installed on your Windows PC is stupidly easy, nothing to it. It goes very smooth. And installs various stuff. New PC, again here down, went on really quick. But with any VPN, a kill switch is critical for any VPN. There's no point using a VPN if you don't have a kill switch. A kill switch will drop off or pause your data for whatever reason if you lose your connection. It can be anywhere along the whole string, so it won't expose your real IP address. I want to mention here now, one of the things in Proton is simple to set up, but in Proton, the kill switch is not turned on by default. You must enable the kill switch. So don't miss that part. It's a one-time deal, and it's simple. So your Proton account can be installed on your cell phone. It's quick and easy. I can use the same Proton account on my desktop PC as my cell phone, my Gmail account. And this is a screenshot of the cell phone setup here, a screenshot here. On the left-hand side on the cell phone, I've shown you that this is the little button for the kill switch. You turn that on once, and you don't do it ever again. You're good to go. As a side topic now, I currently have NordVPN. I've had that for three, four years, maybe more. And NordVPN, did I? So, we're going crazy here. I didn't do that. Okay. Okay, I have NordVPN. So this has allowed me by chance to compare both of them. Nord's expensive, but I can tell you that comparing these two, anyway, I have Nord and Proton right now, and I won't be renewing Nord. There's no way. Proton is fantastic. So anyway, we're almost ready to wrap things up here. But want to mention one thing about public Wi-Fi. If you ever use public Wi-Fi, you must be aware that hackers can create fake Wi-Fi hotspots that look exactly like the store you're in. Now, I love to buy new tools at a big store in Canada. There's a big sale on this week. I haven't got there yet. But my shopping list is always on my cell phone. And I have lots of data on my cell phone. But I can never, ever get a good cell phone signal in that store, even if I go outside. So I'm literally forced to use the in-store Wi-Fi. So don't forget, if you connect to any store Wi-Fi, Starbucks, Tim Hortons, or McDonald's, it may not be the store name you're logging into. It could be a hacker in the same store. Now, a VPN will give you a secure shield even if you're on the wrong hotspot. So if you're using free Wi-Fi, it's not hard for me to get a hotspot on my phone to share with friends and such. It's not quite the same thing, but it may not be the hotspot you think it is. So use your VPN. Anyway, Proton VPN really is all they say it is. There's no ads. There's no trackers. There's no sales data. You never have to enter your credit card. Offers you real security. It's absolutely free. And the free version of Proton can be with many devices, but only one at a time. But I'm not a techie user. I don't like things that are complex. Proton, the speed is amazing, and it's definitely simpler to use than NordVPN. So I haven't told Nord this yet, but we'll be renewing that one. Anyway, other folks, I know Jose and other people have used Proton on the forum, and that sort of sparked me to try it, and any other comments are welcome, but I think it's great. Thank you.
So Natalie wants to know, she says she's using a paid version of Bitdefender that has a limited VPN. Is there going to be a conflict if she uses Proton?
I'm sure not. I never run two at the same time. I haven't tried that, but it turned one off and the other one.
Yeah, personally, you might end up with some conflicts because of the fact that they are at the networking stack level. You definitely don't want to have both of them enabled at the same time. Whether you could just disable one or whether you have to actually uninstall one might be the question, I guess. I don't know if anybody on the call here tonight has actually had two VPNs installed on their computer, if they have any advice.
Can you pause one and then it would go? I don't know.
I don't know. That would be the thing, is whether you can have to disable it or whatever. I have TunnelBear installed on my computer, but I have it turned off almost all the time, only when I'm testing something that I bother turning it on. And that works, but I've never tried with another. Oh, I'll try that out, actually. I'll try Proton and see whether I can leave TunnelBear installed at the same time. I'll report back next week.
Well, I do have Nord and Proton on mine, and
I got
on my laptop also, my laptop and my new PC, so and cell phone. That's three devices. So.
Oh, okay. So it looks like it will work. Yeah.
So, Bob, have you tried the paid version of Proton VPN?
No reason to. There's nothing more I could want on the free version.
Well, if you want to get around the geolocation, you pretty much need the paid version because. The free version, I think, is limited to U.S. and Spain, and that's about it.
No, it's expanded. My presentation was actually, I did that quite a while ago. My PC fried, but I think there's five or seven countries now, not three.
Yeah.
How many do I need? You only need one.
By the same token, Bob, I think that Proton decides which server it's going to use.
Yes, they do. But they do. But if you don't like that place, you can click it again. It's like roll the dice and try one more. And yep.
Just keep trying until you get the country you want.
Yeah, it takes seconds. I mean, it's not a big deal.
Cool. Yeah, that was one thing I did like about Tunnel Bear is that you can actually select different countries. But the problem with Tunnel Bear is you're limited to 500. Put in the chat. I think I said 500 gig, but I think it's megabytes. Yeah, it's megabytes, not gigabytes. So it is quite limited in the amount of traffic you get per month. But it might give Proton VPN a try.
I even tried the video on both of them, and Proton definitely not slower. I can tell you, Proton though was much other than the kill switch. I think some of them don't even have that. But other than the kill switch. Do that once, Proton is simpler, and I don't like complex things. Anyway, thank you all.
The one thing I didn't like about the kill switch, Bob, is if you turn off the VPN, you suddenly can't access the internet, and it doesn't tell you that the reason is because you've got the kill switch set.
Well, I didn't find that problem at all. No, that's
my mistake. You probably run it all the time. I tried turning it off.
I leave mine on, sorry, yes.
Yeah. Bill wants to know if you can use it on an Android phone, can you also use it on a tablet? I'm sure the answer is yes, right?
Yes. I looked it up, even Linux too, Alan.
Okay, and Glenn here had a question. Do you know how much the Proton VPN reduces the data rate compared to not using the VPN?
I didn't measure it. I have speed. I didn't measure it, but I tried the video on both of them, and no YouTube, whatever. So nothing at all. The flow is perfect.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Bob. Great presentation. All right. So I've got a little share here. A while ago, a couple of weeks ago maybe, I was asking for suggestions for computer basics. And everybody's really shy. You don't want to tell me what you need to know, what your favorite apps are or anything. So I decided to give it a kickstart. I'm going to tell you some of the apps that I use routinely. And if anybody wants to know more about them, I've just got brief slides here. If you want to know more about them, then you're going to have to say that you want to know more about them. So first of all, I use Vivaldi as my web browser of choice, and the reason for that basically is because it lets me set the page that it loads if I go to a new tab, and that's because I use this kind of a local HTML menu file instead of using bookmarks. So I use the links here to access all the sites I'm interested in, and if I hit a new tab, then I get a fresh version of the menu. For email, I almost always use an email client, and I like Thunderbird. The good thing about Thunderbird is that it's available for Windows, it's available for Linux, and it's available for Android. So I'm using basically the same program on all three platforms. I have Microsoft Office, but I use LibreOffice a lot. LibreOffice Writer is very compatible with Microsoft Word, and Calc works really well instead of Excel as a spreadsheet. They use different macro programming languages, which means that I use one or the other as I desire. And Impress is not all that compatible with PowerPoint. So one of the reasons I still have Office is Chris and I use PowerPoint a lot. And I find it's easier to use real PowerPoint than trying to make Impress and work as advertised. I quite like Notepad++ as a simple text editor. It's not all that simple. It actually has these tabs, so you can load a number of different files in the same window, and then it's fairly easy to cut and paste between them. It also has plugins. So one of the nice features is it has a compare plugin, where you can compare two text files, and it will give you a colored display and indicate the differences, which makes it really, really good to do the analysis like that. For backup, file and folder synchronization, I use PreFileSync. We've talked a lot about that in Q&A. Chris really likes this program too, and it works really, really, really well. open source, free and open source software. People have also mentioned search engines, and I like everything as a local search engine. It's much better than the Microsoft search built into Windows. So, in fact, I have disabled Microsoft search on my Windows box, and I only use everything. And it's really fast and highly, again, highly configurable in terms of the searches that you want to make. And then this is another favorite of both Chris and I. Again, multi-platform, use the same password manager on both Windows and Linux. And I think there's also an Android version, which Chris uses. I haven't actually got around to that yet. And this is basically recording the login credentials, the username and the password for a whole raft of websites. So all you have to do is remember the master password that unlocks the encrypted database. And then as you can see here, you have a whole window of full of different websites that you can pull up the information from. And it has some automatic capability too, where you can just double click on a username and it will load it into the login window on your browser. And then for image editing, one of the programs I use is GIMP. It's actually a really powerful image editor. Again, it's multi-platform. It's available for both Linux and Windows. It's powerful, but I only use it to do really simple edits like cropping and changing the size of images and that kind of thing. But it's a really very good image editor. Again, free and open source. And then the final one I have right now is a digital image manager. I use Fastone Image Viewer. And if anybody ever used ACDC, which is a paid product, this is essentially a clone of it. And you've got a tree directory where you can navigate through your data files. You can load a folder and it will load the thumbnails. You single click on a thumbnail, you get the preview view that you're seeing in the bottom left hand corner, and if you double click, then the image comes up full screen. So it's really really good for viewing and sorting out images. It also has some batch rename and batch resize capability, which are really useful for dealing with multiple images from cameras, for example. Okay, so if you want to know more about applications, I want to hear from you, and I'm happy to try and fill in the blanks on some of those things or anything else. Okay, next up, Chris has got a share on DNS, I think.
Yeah, this is Dave Plummer. We've talked about him a number of occasions, and he's a YouTuber, used to be a system programmer with Microsoft, and a very knowledgeable guy and a good speaker as well. And so he recently came up with this cast that he had, Are You the Product? And he talks briefly about why a VPN doesn't really do that much for your privacy, with a couple of exceptions, which was actually covered off a little bit today by Bob, about where it can help your privacy in special circumstances. But he says that changing your DNS can actually improve your privacy. And the DNS is the domain name service for anybody who needs that. So it's an explainer, and it's a little bit on the deep and geeky side, but I think even those who don't delve deeply into things can get something a little bit out of it, probably understand it, and definitely able to implement what he said with some additional slides that I actually have. So Dave's instructions, there's nothing really technically wrong, but he didn't go into a lot of the detail that I think you really need to do the configuration. He actually followed up about a week later on Dave's Garage, where he said, yeah, he skipped over a little bit of the configuration stuff, and he said that basically if you look at the screens, it's not that difficult. I have some slides here which cover off the extra information for sure. So the way you go about implementing this is you go to Settings, Network and Internet, and then you click on your adapter. It'll be either Wi-Fi or Ethernet. And you click on the words, not the chevron. Okay, so the or the chevron, you don't click on the where it says on. It'll just toggle it on or off. If you actually click on either the Wi-Fi or the chevron, it will actually bring you to the configuration screen, which is where you have to go to. So then you click on your network, and it'll actually show the network you're currently on. And then you scroll down to the DNS server assignment, and you click on the Edit button. And then you click where it says automatic DHCP is probably what it is going to say currently, and you change it to manual. Then you go down and you toggle on IPv4. And then you enter in your preferred values for DNS. And so in this case here, I'm using 1111 or as an alternate 8888 as the DNS server. And the important thing here is then you toggle on DNS over HTTPS, which is what gives you private DNS. So it encrypts your DNS traffic is what the overall aim is on this particular thing. And then after that, you toggle on the IPv6 and do the same configurations. You just put in the different values for the preferred DNS. But again, toggle on DNS over HTTPS. And then the fallback to plain text, I had it on. If you have that toggled off, there's a potential that if you have a failure on DNS over HTTPS, that it won't resolve anything. I would prefer that it actually just resolves things, but not necessarily encrypts it. But if you want to be super secret on it, you could toggle that to be off. Now, so here we see the results of that. So we come back out after the edit, and you can see here I've got IPv4 DNS servers, and I've got the 1.1.1.1 and 8.8.8.8, and it says encrypted. So that tells you that all your DNS traffic, which is the lookups of where you're going to on the Internet, are encrypted, and nobody, not even your Internet service provider, can tell what servers you're looking up on the Internet. And then you can see the same thing on the IPv6 DNS servers. It has the IPv6 address and encrypted, and the main and the fallback on that. So there are other options for DNS providers. So the ones I used were the first two, which are provided by Cloudflare and Google. So you can use their servers. They are spread around the world. They have many of them. They are reliable, fast. And either of those first two, I have no hesitation at all recommending. OpenDNS is also well known, and Quad9 is also well known, and they provide free DNS server lookups where you can do secure DNS, which is what the whole aim of this particular thing is. So I highly recommend that you actually take a look at Dave's video and see if this is something that would make sense for you. And if so, use the additional slides that I provided to actually take you step by step through the actual configuration of them. Some additional information, the sites you go to for information on the various ones are listed there, and I will paste all of those. Oh, I don't have them handy. I'll paste them in after the presentation into the chat as well. Now, there is one last thing. Configuration as it is instructed by both Dave and myself is a per network installation. What that means is that if you have a laptop, when you're at home, you have to configure it for your home network. And if you go out and about and you go to, say, the Ottawa Public Library, you have to configure it for their network as well, if you want it in effect when you're out there. And if you go to a coffee shop, you have to configure it for their network. A little bit of a pain in the butt to do it. So if you connect to multiple Wi-Fi networks, you know, you have to do it on a network-by-network basis. There's an option in Windows 11 to configure DNS globally. So it doesn't actually work the way that the dialogues say it works. There are some workarounds that will allow you to get Windows DNS to work globally. So no matter what network you're on, it'll take the new settings. But unfortunately, all those workarounds don't allow DNS to be over HTTPS, which is that secure DNS. So unfortunately, as it stands right now, we are faced with, if you have multiple networks that you connect to, you actually have to configure this for each network that you connect to. And there's no way around it that I know of.
Okay, so Karen's put in the chat here, maybe she missed it, but why wouldn't you do this?
Just the fact that you actually have to go in and configure it. Some people don't want to do it. If you, and again, as I said at the end here, if you connect to multiple Wi-Fi networks, you have to configure for each one. So if you go to a new Wi-Fi network, so say you're flying out of the country, so you go to the airport, and then when you connect to their network, if you want it to be private DNS, you have to configure it on that network. So it's just a bit of a pain. If you only have one Wi-Fi network that you connect to, it's not so bad. You configure it once and you're done. And then there are people who don't care, right? As a general rule, I don't really care if my ISP knows where I'm browsing to. Now there are the I worded that a little bit poorly. They don't know the DNS lookups that I'm doing to say where I want to go to. Once I go to a site, my ISP is going to see that, unless I'm on a VPN. And at that point, I'm just transferring my trust level to the VPN provider because they have to know what IP address that I'm actually going to. So a lot of this stuff is like, is it really something you have to be worried about? Most cases, I don't think you really have to be worried about an awful lot of this stuff. Even a VPN server, most of your traffic is encrypted anyways. You cannot use most major internet sites like Google or X or Facebook. You can't use them on an unencrypted session. So your traffic is encrypted from your computer to the end server anyways. So I think a lot of this is not as big a concern as some people think it is, but that's personal. And so you have to decide your threat level, what you're willing to put up with, and what you're willing to try to mitigate.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. So that's the end of our prepared material. Does anybody have any other questions before we do the wrap-up? We're right on the money for the hour schedule. There being no other questions, let me tell you that coming up at the library, Chris is going to be talking about a really important topic, which is backup. So if you're not doing backup, you should be. And if you don't know how to do backup, then go to the main library on Saturday and Chris will explain everything you need to know. Linda is going to be talking about restoring old photos at Rosemount on the 29th. And Fun with Fonts, that's Chris's typography presentation. Really, really neat presentation, very unique, at Centerpoint on October the 4th. So there's, and yet the, all these things are library you have to register for because that's the way library does things. So there you go. All right, as I said last week, I'm actually going to be away for a couple of weeks. So Chris needs some help. We got a number of presentations tonight, so thanks very much to Stefan and Bob Harris and Harvey for providing those shares. So if anybody else wants to do similar type shares, I'm sure Chris would be happy to hear from you. One of the questions in the chat was that Linda would like to know more about everything. Now, I think I did something on everything at a Q&A a while ago. I'd have to check that, but somebody in the chat said that they use everything and they really like it. So somebody, Bob Harris, if you're listening, might want to do a share on everything and give a different perspective on that software than I did earlier. So if you want to give a share, just let Chris know through suggestion box and he'll be happy to include you in the future presentations.
I can check Alan for that possible presentation. Don't you bother. I'll check on the website.
Okay, yeah, you'll find something. I don't remember exactly how detailed it was, but I'm sure I did something.
Okay.
Okay, so next week is the next Q&A. I won't be there, but I'll be thinking of you. And again, as usual, if you have any questions, if you want to follow up on things we've talked about tonight, if you have new topics that you'd like to share, then please send a note to suggestion box, and we'll be happy to put you on the agenda for the next session. So that's everything for me. Hope you enjoyed tonight, and we'll see you next time. Bye now.
Thanks, folks. I just noticed Tom pasted into the chat that, in his view, VPN is most nice to access location-locked videos and things like that. And I wholeheartedly agree with that. For anything that's geo-blocking going on, getting around geo-blocking, a VPN is about the only thing you can actually do, and it is quite effective at doing that. For other things, yeah, you're really transferring your trust from your internet service provider to the VPN provider. So, and there are countries where if you bring a laptop into another, a certain country and you have VPN installed in it, you may be arrested. So make sure you, if you're traveling around the world, make sure you're aware of laws on things like VPNs. I would not want to go to China with a VPN installed. Well, I wouldn't want to go to China anyways, but that's another point. But yeah, if you go into China with a VPN on your computer, you may be in for some problems. Eldon says, does anybody else find LibreOffice essentially Word and tables suddenly crashing?
I have had that happen from time to time, but it's very infrequent.
Yeah. I very, very rarely have used LibreOffice, so I don't think I've ever had a crash in it, but I probably spent, I could count the number of hours I've spent in LibreOffice on one hand, probably.
The good news is when it crashes, it usually recovers.
There you go. And Tom is still using trusty old Office 2007. I don't see anything else in there in the chat. So thanks very much, folks, for showing up. And we'll see you next week. And be kind to me and gentle. I won't have Alan, so yeah, be gentle. I'm a newbie.